asked Anna. My heart leapt in my chest when the desk clerk handed me your letter. Oscar mocked the smile on my face until I came away to write to you. But I was not, am not, even a little embarrassed, and I only raised an eyebrow at his more colorful turns of phrase. When he puts his mind to it, Oscar can fluster anybody. But today he failed with me. I think he was truly shocked. It is a great relief to know that you liked the ring. It wasn't until I had sent it off that I realized that I was putting you in a difficult position. So let me say this clearly. Never pretend with me. If I misstep, you must tell me, and I will do the same. It is one of the things I value most about you, your ability to speak plain where others hold back out of fear or manners or habit. Assuming for a moment that the ring does please you, and that you want it and me, I am happy to know that Sophie and your aunt approve of it. And of the man, as an aside. We are scheduled to testify on the morning of the 17th in Superior Court, and by noon, Oscar and I will be on the way home. If I have to push the train myself, I will arrive at Grand Central on Saturday the 19th, late in the day. I will come to you as soon as we are free of our prisoners. Now, about my sisters. You are right. I didn't think to describe Sophie to them, though in retrospect it is clear that I should have. I am very sorry that Bambina handled herself so badly. I can apologize for my sisters, but the only promise I can make is that they will never again treat Sophie or Mr. and Mrs. Lee or anyone else with anything less than the respect they deserve. There is no excuse for Bambina's behavior, and I would not try to manufacture one, even to quiet your fears. But I do have thoughts about where these opinions originate. Bambina considers herself ugly and undesirable, a belief that goes so deep that I doubt even a sincere marriage proposal from someone she liked would make a difference. And Sophie is beautiful and accomplished, and wears a ring which, to Bambina at least, is anything but ugly. I would guess that she sees the color of Sophie's skin as insult added to injury. I hope and trust she is clear-headed enough to admit fault and change her ways, though it may not happen as quickly as it should. Now I'll surprise you. I do think you should pay Bambina a visit. At some point when it feels right, ask her why we left Italy. This is a subject I have been meaning to raise with you, but it may be a way to start a conversation with Bambina. As to the rest of the family, I wrote to my parents about you and mailed the letter on my way to Grand Central on Monday morning. It will give my mother time to think, so that when she meets you, she will be ready to love you. When I come, I expect to find you with a ring on your finger. I imagine you wearing nothing else, but that falls soundly into the realm of wishful thinking. You and no other, Jack. P.S. I was promised time off in compensation for what was to be a short trip, remember? Now I have grounds to request a couple additional days, and I will see to it that I am available to be inspected by your extended family on the 24th and 25th, on board a ferry, at a wedding breakfast, or anywhere else as long as you are there. I am yours to command.
11th May, 1883. Dear Dr. Anna, I write to say that I have inquired with my friends who live in a district you will not know, the one the coppers call the Tenderloin, asking about the two boys you are looking for. Nobody knows a thing about a Dago kid with blue eyes. Now, it could be that somebody does know something, but is waiting for more encouragement to speak up. This is something I should have talked to you about the day we signed our contract. That information usually comes at a price. If you are willing to put up some kind of reward, please let me know. It might make a difference. Also, on another matter, there is a rumor going around that you are going to marry D.S. Mezzanotte. I have declared this to be a falsehood. Why would someone like Dr. Anna, who has money and position and everything she needs, want a copper for a husband. So now, if this rumor is true, then of course I must offer you my best wishes, but I will also offer you an observation. Even those convicted to the penitentiary can look forward to the day they will be free of the law, but you won't have that comfort. You will have a life sentence with no possibility of parole. I will wait for your instructions on how to proceed. Yours most sincerely, Ned.
11th of May, 1883. Dr. Savard, New Amsterdam Charity Hospital, New York, New York. Dear Dr. Savard, my name is Ambrose Leach. I am a tailor with my own small shop on Broadway. I am a respectable, God-fearing Christian, born and raised in this city. I have as wife a good woman who works hard to make a comfortable home. We have 6 children, the eldest 12 years and the youngest 6 months. The doctor tells us that another child would ruin my wife's health and might well kill her, leaving me with 6 young children to raise on my own and a business to run and operate at the same time. And so I write to you. I need information on how to limit the size of my family, and without delay. Please, Dr. Savard, may I call on you for this purpose? I enclose a $5 note as a sign of my sincerity and hope to hear from you soonest. Ambrose Leach, Post Office Box 1567, New York, New York. Conrad Belmont, Esquire, Belmont and Verhoeven, Attorneys at Law. May 13, 1883. Mr. Anthony Comstock, Secretary, New York Society for the Suppression of Vice, 150 Nassau Street, New York, New York. Dear Mr. Comstock, I am writing on behalf of Doctors Lillian and Sophie Savard in re the matter of the enclosed reproduction of a letter, addressed to the Doctors Savard at their place of employ, New Amsterdam Charity Hospital, and signed Mr. Ambrose Leach. This letter, seeking reliable information on contraception, as well as the purchase of whatever implements necessary, was mailed to Dr. Savard and arrived May 11th, with $5 enclosed. The $5 bill is described as a consultation fee. According to the city directory, there is no tailor named Leach on Broadway or anywhere else in the city, and the tax assessor's office has no record of such a person or business. I am forced to conclude that the letter constitutes an attempt on your part to entrap my clients for violation of the Comstock Act, as you have publicly admitted to doing with other physicians in the recent past. A federal district judge has already thrown out one such case on the grounds that the authorities entrapped the accused, U.S. versus Whittier, 28 Federal Case 591-1878, but if you are eager to see such practices condemned more emphatically by a court closer to home, then by all means proceed on your present course. The Doctors Savard are members of good standing of the New York Society of Physicians and Surgeons, the American Medical Association, the New York Obstetrical Society, and the Association for the Advancement of the Medical Education of Women. Detailed information about this incident will be shared with these and similar organizations, and with the attorneys representing their interests. In the unlikely event I am mistaken as to the provenance of this letter, please accept my humblest apologies. Sincerely yours, Conrad Belmont, Esquire. Copies to Peter Verhoeven, Esquire, John Mayo, District Attorney. Mount Loretto, Staten Island, New York, May 15, 1883. Dear Dr. Savard, in receipt of your letter regarding an orphaned male infant about 3 months old, blue eyes, dark hair. Madam, we have no shortage of such orphans, and every one of them is in dire need of a good Catholic family to adopt them. If you would like to pursue this matter, you may find me at Mount Loretto on Staten Island. Yours in Christ and in His Holy Mother, Father John McKinnaway.
The Foundling Asylum, Sisters of Charity, 175 East 68th Street, New York, New York. May 15, 1883. Dear Dr. Savard, I am in receipt of your letter requesting Sister Mary Augustine's assistance when you call on Father McKinnaway at the Mission of the Immaculate Virgin in the coming week. Sister Mary Augustine has been reassigned to the Mother House, where she can better contemplate devotion to duty and detachment from self. While she will not be joining you, please be assured that we Sisters of Charity pray for you and ask God to guide your heart and hand as you continue your search for the missing Russo children. Dirigit Deus, Sister Mary Irene.
City of Chicago Police Department, 7th District, 943 West Maxwell Street, Chicago, Illinois. Wednesday, May 16, 1883. Dearest Anna, tomorrow at noon we will be boarding the train and on our way home, the DeParaccio brothers in tow. Look for me on Saturday evening. I will be polite for a half hour, and after that I will not want to share you with anyone. So be prepared to go out. Some thoughts about the news in your last letter. I think that Baldy, or rather Ned, is probably right. A reward might be helpful, but the amount is important. Too much will send the wrong message and could cause complications. Do you really need me to tell you your instincts are sound? Or is there something else that has got you worried? As for his suggestions regarding our plans, he is as cheeky as ever, but he is also absolutely right. It is a life sentence for both of us. I was quite surprised by the Comstock business. This is something you haven't told me much about, and I think it is a conversation we need to have as soon as I am home. In the meantime, I think you won't have to worry about him now that you've handed the matter over to Conrad Belmont. Belmont's reputation should be enough to scare off the self-proclaimed weeder in the garden of the Lord for good. A rich, well-connected man who cannot be won over to Comstock's cause is one he avoids at all costs. Finally, I am wondering if you paid Bambina a visit and are keeping that to yourself, or if you are still trying to work up the courage. I fall asleep every night thinking of that last evening we spent together. I once believed that smells could not be recalled in isolation, but the scent of your skin at the nape of your neck is as real to me as the texture of your hair and the shape of your hands. Your beautiful, clever hands. I feel them on my face. Evermore, Jack.
Chapter 18. Anna sat with Jack's letter open in front of her, calculating times and distances yet again, just to be sure of her conclusion. He would be home sometime in the late afternoon or evening of the next day. This was very good news, and at the same time, difficult. She really had been putting off the visit to his sisters, something she would have to do this evening. The day had been particularly long. Two surgeries of her own, assisting at another, a particularly difficult patient who showed up every week because she would not follow instructions on how to care for an ulcerated cheek and would only accept Anna as a doctor, a committee meeting about the usual budget shortfall and plans for raising funds. Of all the duties that came with a position on the hospital staff, fundraising was the worst, without competition. And at the end of the workday, there was the bi-monthly meeting of the Rational Dress Society. It was a commitment she had made long ago, but one that she might have let go, if not for the ongoing debate about corsets around the breakfast table, which had renewed her interest and resolve. All that she had survived, to find herself in the mezzanotte parlor, watching Celestina fuss with bone china coffee cups as transparent as paper held up to the sun. The rims and handles were decorated with green and gold tracery, the kind of detail that would normally escape Anna. But the china was so delicate and beautiful, it drew attention to itself as surely as a single painting on a stark white wall. That thought was still in her head when Bambina came in with a plate of long, narrow biscuits dusted with sugar crystals. They were also as hard as a rock, as Anna soon discovered when she tried to bite down on one. She watched Bambina dipping a biscuit directly into her coffee cup and followed her example. It was almost magical, the way it crumbled on her tongue to a buttery mass of crumbs that tasted of sweet coffee and vanilla and anise. "These are very good," she said quite sincerely. "The little experience I've had with Italian cooking gives me the sense that I will like it all." "Experience?" Celestina smiled at her, inviting but not demanding more information. "Jack once shared a sandwich of roasted pork. It may have been the best thing I have ever eaten. I still think of it sometimes, but I always forget to ask him where it came from." Both sisters were smiling. "That must have been Aunt Filomena," said Celestina. "She's a wonderful cook. Jack eats with them once or twice a week when we are away at home. Though I suppose..." She broke off, embarrassed. Anna did not consider herself insensitive, but she saw now that she had been oblivious to one crucially important aspect of their plans, one that would explain much of the nervous agitation in the room. When their brother married, the sisters would find themselves without a male protector. These two were raised to run a household, to care for others and to make beautiful things with their hands. They would never see themselves as independent, even if their needlework brought them sufficient income to make that claim. Unless Anna were to come here to live with all three of the mezzanottes, Celestina and Bambina faced an uncertain future. But she could make them no promises. Not at this moment. Maybe never. Someone would have to move, and any move would disrupt this household in ways that could only be imagined. She said, tongue-tied for once in her life. "I think I'll need a map of some kind to sort through all the mezzanotte relatives. I haven't even met your Uncle Massimo yet." Celestina smiled as though she had been handed a gift and shot up from her seat. "What was I thinking? I'll go get him now. He's still in the shop. And you haven't met the cousins." "Wait," said Bambina. But the door was already closing behind her sister. Bambina looked almost panicked, and Anna wondered if Jack had written to express his disappointment with her after all. Anna wondered what subject she could raise that would put both of them at ease. She said, "This china is very beautiful." "Yes, isn't it? It was my grandmother's, my mother's mother." "You brought it from Italy?" "I was born here," Bambina said, "but it came over with my parents, yes. It came to my mother when her mother died. She was the only daughter." And there it was, the opening she needed to ask the question Jack had suggested. But the truth was, after such a difficult and drawn-out day, she had little stomach for what would certainly be an awkward conversation. If not for the memory of Sophie's expression, the stillness that had come over her when Anna raised the subject of Jack's sisters, she might have let this go. But she did remember. "Why did your parents decide to leave Italy?" Bambina drew in a deep breath. "My brother didn't tell you. He suggested I ask you to tell me the story." Bambina's fingers began to trace the patterns of chevrons on her jacket sleeve. For a moment, Anna wondered if she would simply ignore the question, but then she nodded to herself. "The families, both of them, disapproved of the marriage," she said. "My father's brothers and Grandmother Bassani were the only members who didn't disown them, and when she died, my parents decided to start new in the United States. My uncles, Massimo and Alfonso, were already here, and that gave them a place to land.
But why did the families object?
Anna asked, curious now.
You are not Roman Catholic,
Bambina said, an odd turn in the conversation. She waited for Anna's nod.
Neither is my mother. She is from Livorno, the granddaughter of Reb Yaron Bassani. He was one of the city's most respected rabbis.
She fell silent, her eyes fixed not on Anna, but on the wall behind her.
Your mother is Jewish,
Anna said in an even tone, one she didn't have to manufacture.
Bambina was expecting her to be shocked and disturbed by this news, as many people disliked Jews on principle.
Anna was not one of them, for reasons that she couldn't list without sounding as though she were pandering.
But this single fact explained so much about Jack and the man he was. It felt almost like the missing piece of a puzzle.
Did your mother convert when she married your father?
A muscle fluttered in the girl's jaw.
No, which made my father's family very unhappy.
That must have been very hard for her as a young mother. Do you consider yourself Roman Catholic or Jewish?
Her gaze was steady and cool.
I claim neither. Why is that important?
It's not unusual, I would think, Anna said. I'd guess it is even quite common for the children of a mixed marriage to avoid or even reject both sides.
Bambina frowned elaborately, her brows drawing down to an angle as defined as an arrowhead.
You would call this a mixed marriage between a Jew and a Catholic?
It would be considered mixed by most people, Anna said. But my family has been flouting expectations and traditions for 100 years. My grandfather Bonner's first wife was Mohawk, and the daughter of that marriage, my Aunt Hannah, married a man from New Orleans who had African, Seminole, and French grandparents. We are a complicated and colorful family. We avoid labels.
The younger woman closed her hands around her cup as if they needed warming and sipped slowly. Anna took the opportunity to study her.
It was true that Bambina was not especially pretty, but neither was she ugly. She had a round face, full cheeks, and a strong nose, but she also had beautiful eyes with thick dark lashes and a full mouth, and she was intelligent. Just now, her expression was much like Jack's when he was working through a problem.
You must know, Anna went on more slowly, that after the war, New York was overwhelmed with people like your parents, who left one place to start again in another. Sophie was just 10 when she lost her family and home and left everything familiar behind to come here. From that time, we have been as close as any sisters.
My mother is Jewish, Bambina said. She is not colored. You can't compare the two.
Her tone was confrontational and also resentful. She was surprised that Anna would pursue the subject.
Anna met Bambina's gaze and reached carefully for the right tone. People descended from African slaves and the Indian tribes have some things in common with Jews. All three have survived despite open hostility and violence and even banishment. The Jews were driven out of Italy at one time. Isn't that so?
Bambina's gaze snapped toward her.
Why would you know that?
I had a broad and liberal education, and beyond that, we have family friends who are Jewish. I have students and colleagues who are Jewish. Sophie's mentor is Jewish.
I still don't see the comparison.
Her expression was chilly.
Have you ever seen your mother being cut or openly insulted because of her religion?
No. Should I have?
And that's why your parents decided to leave Italy,
so you wouldn't experience what it's like to have someone you love insulted or demeaned openly, Anna said. But I would hope you could imagine a thing, even if you haven't experienced it personally. There was a moment of fraught silence, and then Celestina came into the room, breathless. They all want to meet you, she said, but they don't want to come into the house in their work clothes. Aunt Filomena wants us to walk down to their house at the end of the block. Anna stood and smoothed her skirts. Well, then, that's easy enough. She smiled at Bambina. Will you come along? But Bambina disappeared down the hall toward the kitchen without another word. Chapter 19. The next day, Anna explained it to Sophie in simple terms. The daughter of a well-to-do and prominent Jewish family and the son of Livorno's biggest landowner fell in love, defied their parents, and married. Bambina made an excuse to get away from me and disappeared upstairs, Anna said. But Celestina told me the whole story. The key point is, Rachel Bassani became Rachel Mezzanotte, and her father disowned her. But her mother didn't. Her mother refused to be cut off from Rachel. She was their best ally and support. On Ercole's side, things were a little better. He had 5 brothers, and they all supported the marriage. The 2 oldest of the brothers were already here, and the other 3 followed. The Mezzanotes have been busy populating New York and New Jersey ever since. And how did this subject come up? Sophie wanted to know. Her expression said she had certain ideas, but she wanted Anna to confirm them. Jack thought I should talk to her.
Ah?
Did you think it did any good? It gave her something to think about.
It gave you a lot to think about, too, Sophie observed.
It does make sense, Anna said. If he had grown up in a traditional Italian family with strong ties to the Catholic Church, we wouldn't be sitting here talking about him.
There were a dozen other issues that hung in the air, unvoiced, unanswered. But Sophie was yawning in the helpless way of the truly exhausted, and she was still planning on going to see Cap today, though she had been out most of the previous night treating a 7-year-old with meningitis. When Anna asked her about it, she woke up a little, as if it was something she needed to share.
On the Bend, she said.
Mulberry Bend was the very worst of the tenements. Hundreds of rooms, airless, lightless, no larger than closets, overrun with vermin, where whole families slept in shifts. The place where the most desperate and violent kept each other warm.
7 children in the same room. The hardest part was convincing the parents that the boy was contagious and had to be isolated.
I finally sent for an ambulance and admitted him to Women and Children's. Jenny Fairpiff agreed to put him on her patient list, though I would guess he has already died. It was on Anna's tongue to ask Sophie why she was still taking calls. She had already resigned from the hospitals and dispensaries where she saw patients, precisely because all her time was taken up with the preparations for a wedding and a long journey, and with Cap, who didn't want to let her out of his sight, now that he finally had his way.
You have done so much, Sophie. You have nothing to feel guilty about.
Sophie made a low humming sound, one that said very clearly that she did not agree and did not care to argue this subject they had gone over so many times. From out in the hall came the sound of Leah climbing the stairs, singing to herself in time to the thump of her doll's head as it met each step. Then a small face appeared around the edge of the door frame, eyes wide with anticipation. Anna got up.
Leah, is it time to go?
To Lilliput,
Leah told Sophie,
to eat ice cream.
Errands first, Anna said, and then, if you are not too tired after errands, Lilliput. And ice cream.
She reached toward Leah, who jumped away, giggling.
Caps sent the carriage, Sophie said, and I'm running late, but I can take you as far as Madison Square.
At the last minute, Margaret decided that Anna could not be trusted with decisions about petticoats and footwear and hats, and so three women and two little girls climbed into Cap's fine carriage with the help of taciturn Mr. Vale for the trip north to Madison Square. For a moment, Anna considered retiring and leaving the whole endeavor to Margaret, who liked visiting shops after all. But the little girls were so excited to have her along. Anna realized, with something like guilt, that she had rarely been out of the house with them. And, of course, at home in the quiet of an almost empty house, she would have nothing to distract her from thinking about Jack, who was on a train headed this way. Rather than watching the clock, she would concern herself with little girls and the Lilliput Children's Emporium. Another set of doubts arose for Anna when they waved goodbye to Sophie, as the carriage bore her away to Park Place. On her way to spend the afternoon with Cap and whatever visitors came to call, overflowing with curiosity and in some cases malice. Even if no one called, Cap would take joy in arguing about every detail of the events to come.
Because he can't touch me, Sophie said, the next best thing is to make me mad. It was entirely possible, Anna thought, that the joy of having Sophie nearby would be eclipsed by the reality of not having her close enough.
Even illness could not banish sexual desire completely, though she had doubts that Cap would find the strength, even if the possibility presented itself. And thus the anger, which must have an outlet. It had been terrible to see them both so unhappy in the year of Cap's self-imposed separation. But in some ways, this resolution, together but not together, was just as hard. Once the engagement had been publicly announced, Cap put his plans into action in anticipation of visitors, the curious, the gossip mavens, the disgruntled relatives who would come to call. The Astors and De Peisters and the rest of the old Knickerbocker families would not come. Cap had effectively removed himself from their understanding of the world, and they would not see him if he were to meet one of them face to face on the street. Cap didn't care. Of that, Sophie was sure. She herself had no interest in formal visits with the Commodore's widow, but she did resent the rejection of Cap, who was going away and would not be back again. The parlor had been transformed since the formal announcement of their engagement. Most of the furniture had disappeared, leaving just two seating areas, one for Cap on the farthest wall between two windows, and the other 20 feet away. The heavy draperies had gone the way of the missing furniture, and all the windows stood open, so that the parlor was filled with soft spring light and a tripling breeze. It was unorthodox and alarming and utterly pleasing to Sophie. Not in the smallest part because it reminded her of New Orleans, where houses were built to welcome fresh air rather than keep it out. She thought of all that heavy, valuable fabric, and at the same time of Jack Mezzanotte's sisters, who would know how to put it to good use. She wondered what the gossips would say if she were to make a gift of Mrs. Verhoeven's silk and brocade drapery to Italian needle workers. "Something for them to focus on other than your pretty face," Cap had said when she asked about the missing furniture and finery.
"Something more to be outraged about," she came back.
"Don't begrudge Aunt Undina her only source of entertainment," he said with a grin. But Sophie knew he was worried about his mother's sisters, or at least two of them. The less difficult of the two was Eugenie, who believed that because she had married a first cousin and retained the family name, her son Andrew should be Cap's heir. Undina was more difficult. She objected to everything, it seemed, on principle, and she never conceded. Sophie might simply have forbidden visitors and given the importance of rest as her reason, but she was choosing her battles carefully.
And it's hard to censure him when his spirits are so much improved, Anna pointed out, voicing that exact thought Sophie had not wanted to contemplate. The fact was that Cap overflowed with renewed energy, at least in part because overindulging in laudanum. When she confronted him, he assured her that all would be well as soon as they were married and on their way. He would put himself in his wife's care and follow every direction. At that, she snorted a laugh, and he returned a lopsided grin. And so, sitting apart, they received visitors. His Belmont aunts and uncles and some cousins, many old enough to be his parents. With the exception of Bram and Baltus and Cap's uncle Conrad, most of the family members who visited were ill at ease or suspicious or both. None of them had the nerve to come out and say what they were thinking, or even why they had come. There were no congratulations to Cap, though most of them managed to greet Sophie politely. Undina had not yet called, but Conrad had predicted that the day had come. He had suggested that Sophie find something else to do. Undina would not hesitate to say what she believed must be said, and she would not spare anyone's feelings. When her fiancé fell at Spotsylvania some 20 years before, Undina Belmont had put on mourning and had yet to give it up. She held on to her memories, her pennies, and every slight, real or imagined, with grim intensity. The twins called her Aunt Costive behind her back. As Sophie reached the front door, Undina's carriage pulled up. So Conrad had been right. She slipped in with a nod to Mrs. Harrison and made straight for the parlor, where Cap had settled for the afternoon. "She's on the doorstep," Sophie said.
"Oh, good," said Bram. "I was afraid we were going to miss the fun."
Cap said, "A half hour and you need never again deal with Undina Belmont." When Undina came into the parlor, Bram and Baltus leapt to their feet and offered their aunt every comfort with exaggerated proper manners and good cheer, which only made her shiver with annoyance. Then she turned her gaze first to Cap and then to Sophie, who she regarded as she would a serpent curled on a silk pillow, a calculated insult, dangerous and odd at the same time. It was true that she would have objected to Sophie if her skin were white, Sophie being overeducated, overopinionated, and unworthy on general principles. The twins finally retreated to the card table in the corner, and Conrad shifted so that he was facing the sofa where his sister had taken a seat. She maintained a chilly composure in Conrad's presence, even when he set out to provoke her. And he was so very good at it. In part, Sophie was sure, because he had been blinded in the war and did not hesitate to use that fact to his advantage. And these two had grown up together and knew each other's secrets.
"Sophie,"
Conrad said, holding out his hand until she came to sit beside him,
"Cap's Aunt Undina has come to welcome you into the family."
To Sophie, it was obvious that Undina feared and resented her eldest brother, just as she disliked the twins and disapproved of Cap and was horrified by Sophie. She wondered if anyone met with the older woman's approval, and thought not. It was sad, but it wasn't enough to make her put down her guard. To her brother, Undina said,
"Conrad, this is a serious matter."
"It is indeed,"
said Cap from across the room. His voice was reedy with effort, but he produced his grimmest smile.
"We're about to travel halfway around the world." "Undina has never been to Europe,"
Conrad supplied smoothly, cutting his sister off before she could reply to Cap's willful misunderstanding. Sophie, tired of being ignored, stepped in.
"Neither have I, but I'm looking forward to it."
Truly, she was mostly looking forward to the end of the turmoil that would dog them to the altar.
Undina said, "Conrad, I hold you responsible for this entire debacle."
Surprised, Sophie raised a brow at Cap. He gave a curt shake of the head that told her it would be best to stay out of the discussion.
If you had done your duty and married and produced a son, we would not be sitting here facing social ruin. As the head of the family, you should know this without being told.
Conrad pursed his mouth thoughtfully.
Cap is my dearest sister's only child, the first of his generation, and as much as a son to me. In my opinion, and that is all he need take into account, he has chosen well.
It is not just your concern.
Her voice began to wobble with anger, and her tongue darted to touch her thin upper lip.
It is family business. It is this family's shame.
Undina,
Conrad said, with a chilly edge that Sophie thought was more at home in a courtroom.
If you cannot be civil and ladylike, you must leave.
I am the only lady in this room, and I am not finished, she said stiffly. I have more to say.
Pardon me, Sophie said, while I see what's holding up our tea.
As she closed the parlor door behind herself, Sophie heard Undina Belmont say,
What kind of lawyers are the two of you? Have you never heard of miscegenation laws? I quote, If any white person intermarry with a colored person, he shall be guilty of a felony and shall be punished by confinement in the penitentiary.
Congratulations, Cap interrupted. You can read, but you should always start with the title. That is the law in Virginia, I believe. We find ourselves in New York State. Is your mind wandering of late, Aunt Undina?
Sophie knew very well what was coming. Cap would twist his aunt into knots, challenging her understanding of history, geography, law, ethics, and medicine, until she got up and stormed out of the house. None of it was new, and so she took her time visiting with Cook, went outside to talk to the gardener about the health of his rose bushes, and then went to the room that had been set aside for her use. She washed her face and considered herself in the mirror. Her family history was there to read, in her bones and skin and hair, in the blue-green eyes that identified her as red bone in the South, a term some thought as offensive as anything Undina Belmont could come up with. But Cap didn't care about any of that, and Cap was the only thing that mattered. Sophie took her time and still managed to cross paths with Undina as she came into the hall, riding the veil over her face. She stopped and turned.
Miss Savard, she said.
Sophie inclined her head, acknowledging both the greeting and the denial of her medical degree.
Miss Belmont?
Very cleverly done, Undina said.
Sophie smiled at her, her best manners on display.
Yes, she said solemnly. Cap has done very well for himself.
Then she ducked around Undina and into the parlor, where Conrad was laughing silently, his whole long thin shape contorted with pleasure. Cap's smile was quieter, but he looked at her with all the love and affection he had to offer. And that would be more than enough to put all the Undinas of the world out of her mind. Anna had set out on this expedition determined to hold on to her sense of humor and patience both, and found it easier than she had imagined. It was the little girls who made the difference, in part because they were amazed by everything, and in part because shopkeepers seemed to be drawn to them, and in equal part because their presence kept Margaret from starting conversations sure to cause a disagreement. They picked out lace and bonnets and summer weight stockings, stopped by the seamstresses to have pinafores and skirts pinned up for alteration, received purchases Aunt Quinlan had ordered from a jeweler. At 4, they had come as far as the Lilliput Children's Emporium, where the girls were allowed to look at toys and dolls as long as they did not touch. They finished up in the shoe department, where both of them were fitted with buff-colored leather half-boots, suitable for both summer outings and a small wedding. Leah was beside herself with joy. Rosa, still somber, expressed her thanks and appreciation and fell back into silence. Anna fought still with the impulse to tell her about the upcoming trip to Staten Island and the hope that they would find her little brother, wanting so much to see some hope in that small, serious face. But Jack and Sophie and Aunt Quinlan were united in the belief that it would be worse to raise her hopes only to dash them yet again, and so she had to content herself with small gestures instead of fragile promises. As a last stop, they went to the confectioner's just two doors down, a place that smelled of caramelized sugar and yeast and cinnamon, French pastries filled with cream and drizzled with chocolate, layer cakes and torts, and little pétophores crowned with fruit as bright as jewels. They were shown to a table while Leah expressed her wishes in very concrete terms, waving the menu as if it were personal standard.
"Chocolate ice cream," she said, "with wafers and cherries and whipped cream."
"After something more substantial," Anna said. "Sandwiches and a pot of peppermint tea, I think." A hint of rebellion showed itself on Leah's face, but her sister's sharp look was enough to nip insurrection in the bud.
"You'll like these sandwiches," Margaret promised the girls.
And they did. A plate of small triangles, white and brown bread trimmed of all crust and filled with delicate slices of cucumber, potted cheese, and slivers of pink ham. The little girls hesitated at first, and then ate up the whole platter under Margaret's watchful eye and constant small corrections. Anna was just starting to long for home when she saw Rosa's face transform itself, all worries falling away to reveal a little girl whose fondest wish had just been granted. Even as Anna turned to follow Rosa's gaze, she knew that Jack was coming toward them. Bold and dark and strong in this pastel-colored place designed for ladies and children. She twisted around and met his gaze, and knew that she could not hide from him or anyone at all what she was feeling. His fingers brushed her shoulder as he passed by her chair and to the other side of the table to stand behind Rosa, who was chattering at him in Italian. He put his hands on her shoulders and leaned down to talk to her. Just a few words in Italian, but the tears that had been welling in her eyes subsided as she nodded and smiled and swallowed. Then Leah had hooked her hands around his forearm and demanded her share of his attention. Anna watched all this and felt her own throat swell so that even when Jack came to her and leaned over to kiss her cheek, she had not a word to offer him. The waiter brought another chair, and there was a good 5 minutes of adjusting and moving and ordering of more sandwiches and ice cream, during all of which Anna had nothing to say. Finally, Jack turned to her, pressing her shoulder with his own. Under the table, he caught her hand and put it on the long, hard plane of his thigh to trace her ring. Her fingers twitched, and he folded his hand around hers. He said, "I've robbed you of speech." Anna nodded, and the little girls giggled, so delighted that they bounced on the red leather cushions of their chairs. Even Margaret was flushed with excitement. She wanted to know how Jack had found them. "I stopped by Waverly Place," he said. "Mrs. Lee told me where I might find you, and here you are. Though Anna still won't talk to me." Jack, who remembered the shape of her hands and the texture of her skin and the smell of her hair at the nape of her neck. Under the table, he squeezed her hand. "Maybe she's changed her mind about marrying me." "Have you, Anna? Changed your mind?"
Leah chirped. "Allora io ti sposerò."
"Ma," Jack said, leaning across the table to stroke the little girl's cheek. "That's a relief. Leah will marry me if you've changed your mind, Anna."
"Leah," Anna said,
It's a very kind offer, but you will have to find someone else to marry. Detective Sergeant Mezzanotte is spoken for.
Jack traced a pattern over Anna's palm, just to feel her tremble. This wasn't exactly the way he had hoped to find her, but there were some advantages. He had never seen her so reticent or flustered. She vibrated with the need to be kissed, and he wanted nothing so much as to oblige her. Then the food and ice cream arrived, and there was a moment's quiet while they turned their attention to their plates and bowls, all except Margaret, who wanted to know about the prisoners he had brought back from Chicago and where they had ended up.
"I don't know," Jack said, which was not exactly the truth, but close enough.
A couple of patrolmen took charge of them in the station. "You don't need to worry, you know. Even if they were out on the street, you wouldn't need to worry. They are very polite. Gentlemen of the First Order, unless you're getting on a train, in which case they'll take your money, give you a worthless piece of paper in return, and bend over backward thanking you for your patronage."
"Forgers."
Margaret sounded almost disappointed.
"Not even money, but train tickets."
"Oh, a train ticket," Leah announced. "I love a train ticket. I got one of those at home."
"You wouldn't know a train ticket if it bit you on the nose," said her sister.
Leah was unconcerned by this accusation, her mouth too full of ice cream.
"Leah," Jack said, "your English is almost as good as your sister's. Did you swallow a dictionary?"
She waved her spoon like a queen with a scepter.
"Oh, a dictionary," she said agreeably. "I love a dictionary."
"She's got one of those at home,"
Rosa finished for her, and Jack couldn't help himself. He laughed out loud. For this moment, he was content to sit with Anna beside him and talk to the little girls and even to Margaret, who had the makings of a police officer, if such things were possible, or a nun, if she were Roman Catholic. She spoke up as if she had read his mind.
"These girls need to get home, Anna. Shall I go on with them?"
She managed to offer both help and disapproval in those few words, a skill that Jack had observed before in mature women who were worn to the bone by loneliness and loss.
"We'll all go," he said. "I'd like to say hello to your Aunt Quinlan, and then Anna and I have an appointment to keep."
In an awkward scramble, they managed to get two cabs, only to be held up by the girls, who both wanted to ride with Jack. The long afternoon had begun to wear on them, and tears and tempers were ready to erupt. In the end, Jack took the girls in one cab and left Anna and Margaret to the other. Anna was damp with perspiration and her heart was thundering in her ears, but she worked hard to maintain a placid expression that would give Margaret nothing to grab onto. Margaret said,
"It's good to see you so happy."
Surprised, Anna had to gather her thoughts before she could reply.
"But I haven't been unhappy."
She heard the defensive tone in her own voice and wondered what she was protecting, her understanding of herself or Margaret's. The truth was, her life before Jack was a good life. She had fulfilling work and a family she loved. There were new things for her to discover every day. And that was the key, Anna realized. Margaret thought of her own life as a thing of the past and anticipated nothing beyond more of the same.
"You could change things," Anna said. "You really could start out on a different life for yourself. You are not nearly so old as you feel."
Margaret smiled at her.
"I was brought up to be a wife and a mother. I never wanted any other occupation, and I still don't. Really, all I want..." She stopped.
"Go on," Anna said.
"All I want is a household of my own," Margaret said, "with my own people, who look to me first instead of last."
Anna thought of Bambina and Celestina Mezzanotte,
and of all the other women she knew who considered themselves less than women because they had no households or husbands or children to care for. And she thought of Jack, the kind of man she had never even dared imagine. She said, "If you had broken bones or a punctured lung, I could help you. I wish there were more I could do." The two of them sat quietly side by side, swaying with the movement of the cab as it dodged one way and then another, through traffic around Union Square, and turned toward Waverly Place. Sophie was still at Cap's, but everyone else was in the garden when Anna and Margaret got home, Jack and the little girls included. There was a great deal of talk and laughter, and then a spirited discussion about supper. Jack wanted to take Anna away to an appointment. She was still unclear on exactly what he meant with that word, but she had her suspicions and promised to come back for Sunday dinner the very next day. There was a lot to discuss, after all. Aunt Quinlan took his face in her hands when he bent down to kiss her cheek and studied his eyes for a long moment. "Endeavor to deserve her," she said, and let him go. "It's what her father said to her first husband when they married," Anna explained as they went back through the house. "Her husband said it to all her daughter's husbands." Jack caught her wrist and drew her up against him while pressing her to the wall in the cool shadows of the front hall. When he had kissed her, less kiss than she had anticipated, but sweet nonetheless, he rubbed his cheek against hers. "Did she say the same to Cap?"
"Multiple times, I'm sure."
He kissed her again, more seriously now and with all his attention.
"Wait."
It was the only word she could get out between one kiss and the next, and in response, she got only the curve of his smile pressed to her cheek. She pulled away to say,
"You can't smile and kiss me at the same time."
"Watch me," Jack said.
"What about this mysterious appointment?"
He let her go, nodding.
"There is that. Come on, let's get it over with."
They crossed Washington Square Park at a sharp angle, Jack only slowing when he realized she was almost running to keep up. Her expression was one he couldn't quite place, but the tone of her voice gave her irritation away.
"Where exactly are we going?"
He gestured with his chin to the southern border of the park.
"Mazzini's Hotel."
She pulled up short and he stopped too.
"Hotel?"
"Mazzini's, yes."
A line appeared between her brows.
"For what purpose?"
And now he understood. He hadn't been clear, and her mind had gone off in the wrong direction. An intriguing direction, but wrong. She stood in front of him in the late afternoon sunshine, framed all around by dogwood and crabapple trees in blossom, with her own color rising in her cheeks. The most sexually open woman he had ever known, but inexperienced, too. Confused and affronted and aroused on top of all that. He could not resist.
"You're asking about my purpose?"
She crossed her arms and scowled at him, then stepped back when he stepped toward her. Jack advanced at a leisurely pace and she retreated step for step.
"What purpose do you imagine I have?"
The next step brought her back up against a dogwood tree, and a flurry of petals fell, catching on her hair and shoulders. She was beautiful and irritated and confused.
"Did you think I meant to seduce you in a hotel room?"
He propped a forearm against the tree trunk just over her head and leaned in to smell her hair.
"Is that what you imagined?"
She pushed at him, half laughing now.
"Get away."
"But I just got back."
He nuzzled her temple as she pushed and pushed at his chest, and then, relaxing, slipped her arms around his waist and turned her face up to his.
Did you really think I was taking you to a hotel room?
She bit the lining of her cheek. If you had just told me...
You did think I was taking you to a hotel room.
Anna ducked as if to slip away, but he caught her up again. There were people on the paths, people who could see them, and at this moment, he didn't care, and more than that, he didn't want Anna to care either. So he kissed her, until she forgot about the tree at her back and the park all around, and the people in the park, and everything in the world but the two of them. Then he took her hand and pulled her away, to run with him through the park, breathless and flushed with a youth he had thought long past. There was a chalkboard just outside the hotel lobby, bracketed by the American flag on one side and the Italian flag on the other. An announcement had been written out carefully in English and Italian both. Monthly meeting of the Italian Benevolent Society today at 6 p.m. Wait, Jack said, holding her back a moment. I have to confess. This meeting is being held in a room. In a hotel. Anna pinched him with her hard surgeon's fingers and was satisfied with the yelp he produced. Then they were in the lobby and surrounded by a crowd of men who came toward Jack as if he were a long-lost son, stopping in an almost comic way all at once when they saw Anna. Jack put his arm around her waist in an overtly possessive gesture that should have irritated her. But she could not be agitated about his willingness to claim her publicly, nor could she even deplore that inability in herself. Because Jack was home, and he had brought her here to show her off. She was vain enough to be pleased, and embarrassed, too. They were shopkeepers, carpenters, restaurant owners, cigar makers, laborers, masons, stable owners, grooms, manufacturers of pianos and pipes and hairbrushes. And they all held Jack in high esteem and extended the same to her. And there was a meeting during dinner, all of the discussion in Italian. Anna recognized some words now, thanks to the Russo sisters and Jack: orphan, family, money, school. While she picked at her food, small square noodle packets filled with spiced meat, all in a combination of soft cheese and cooked tomatoes, Jack was asked a question, and he answered in a tripling Italian that made Anna realize how slowly he had spoken otherwise. Finally, the liquor and cigars came out, and Jack squeezed her hand and gestured with his chin toward the door. Anna felt like a child let out of school, but she resisted the urge to hurry. She was a highly educated, mature woman who did not have to give in to every impulse, but the urge to skip stayed with her all the way home. All the way home, they talked. About Chicago and the taciturn chief of detectives, about Anna's cases over the last week, about Bambina and Sophie and the wedding. Not once did Jack stop to kiss her. She wondered why, and then explained it to herself in a half dozen reasonable ways. He was exhausted after such a long and difficult trip. His sisters were waiting at home and would begin to worry. He still had to go into the station to make a report. And so on, until they turned onto Waverly Place, and her disappointment got the upper hand.
You're just taking me home?
His brow quirked. You have an early surgery tomorrow, didn't you say?
She found herself staring at him, dropped her gaze, and lifted it again, unsure of herself suddenly. He was saying,
Tomorrow will be busy for me, too. It may be late evening by the time I'm finished. Should I come by then?
Yes. Her voice sounded a little hoarse. I would be glad to see you. She tugged on his hand, and he looked down at her.
I'm glad to see you now, mezzanotte.
But all she got for her trouble was a chaste kiss at the door and a promise about the next day. He was truly tired, or he was making the point that he could be patient. Something Anna had not asked him to do or be, because it was a skill she lacked herself. Over the next few days, Anna saw Jack often, but never for more than a half hour at a time, and always in the middle of a crowd of people who wanted to see him almost as much as Anna did. She realized that the inability to keep Jack to herself for any amount of time at all was making her cranky, but there was no easy solution. His cousin Umberto's lodgings at the greenhouse had been claimed by a different cousin, whose rooms had been damaged in a fire, news Bambina shared with Anna when they met for dinner on Monday. Bambina's tone was entirely too satisfied. Out of his sister's hearing, Anna told Jack about this.
She knows about, you know.
He raised an eyebrow in mock confusion. About the rotter?
About the night before you left for Chicago.
And when he still pretended ignorance, she poked him so hard that he captured her hand and held it still in self-defense. He was trying not to laugh. They don't know anything, and if they suspect, does it really matter? It didn't matter, but it felt as though it did, and that irritated. She was a seething mass of irritations. Bending low to speak directly into her ear, Jack said, "Are you feeling deprived? Because," he tightened his hold ever so slightly, "I am." Somehow that made it all better, and Anna went back to the dinner table with Jack right behind her, so close that she could feel the heat of his body all along her spine. Celestina, always the peacemaker, asked Anna about the search for the Russo brothers, a subject that made both girls put aside their gifts and turn toward her. "I'm afraid there's not anything of substance to report. We've written to 46, 51, Rosa corrected her. "As of last night, 51. Anna smiled at her. Different places, asylums and child welfare agencies, individuals who might have some information. I hired a young man who was once a newsboy and is very well connected to ask questions. But we've had no positive responses."
16 letters weren't answered at all, Rosa said in a low voice.
Rosa keeps track of the correspondence, Anna explained.
You can read English?
Celestina asked, and Rosa sat up very straight.
I'm practicing every day. Auntie Margaret says I'm making excellent progress.
That she is, Anna said. Leah took hold of the conversation by telling Jack's sisters about the stories they were hearing at bedtime. She got off her chair to act out part of the boy who cried wolf, so delighted with this opportunity to pass the story on that they had to laugh with her. The little girl had managed something that had seemed to Anna too much to hope for. The tense expectation that radiated from Bambina let up and then disappeared. And another thing for which Anna was very thankful, the impromptu storytelling crowded out any questions that might have been coming her way about wedding plans. Later, when Jack walked her home, he said, "They are trying not to be impatient, but it's hard to hold back the questions. My mother is just as bad. I get a letter almost every day." Anna's life had always been busy. She could spend every waking hour at the hospital and never run out of things to do. And now there were two little girls, two missing brothers, Sophie's wedding, Cap's farewell, and the entire Mezzanotte clan, and the idea of her own wedding to juggle.
And Jack.
"Do you belong to a lot of associations like the Italian Benevolent Society?" He shrugged.
"Two or three. When there are legal matters to deal with, I'm often called in. There aren't many lawyers in the city who speak Italian."
Anna considered. The obvious question was, did he want to be that lawyer? He was not too old to read law, after all. But as forward-thinking as Jack Mezzanotte might be, few men liked having their career choices challenged. Instead, she said,
"I should learn Italian.
It would be helpful.
If I can find the time.
You have a willing tutor right beside you.
We'll never have a moment's quiet time.
Jack squeezed her hand.
Italian lessons can happen any time, spontaneously.
Anna was glad of a cool evening breeze on her cheeks.
On demand?
If there's a room available, certainly, or a suitable hotel.
And here they were, back at the original problem.
Not for the first time she wondered what other people who had no place to be alone together did. The birth rate was evidence that such things happened constantly and everywhere, and not just between married people who shared a bed.
What are you thinking? He wanted to know.
Anna started out of her thoughts.
About privacy, she said, and the reason people rush into marriage. Chapter 20.
3 days later, Jack said,
"There's something I wanted to tell you about."
Anna looked up from the medical journal article she was reading. They were sitting in the garden while the girls played hide and seek. For once, there were no other adults nearby. She said,
"I'm listening."
"Where's your aunt?"
Anna's brows slanted down into a V-shape.
"Why?"
"Because I wanted to tell her about it, too."
"Staten Island?"
"No," he said, vaguely irritated.
"We're not going."
"We will go, but that's not what I wanted to talk to you about."
"And when will that happen, the trip to Staten Island?"
He realized she was winding him up, and let out what he hoped would sound like a long-suffering sigh.
"Saturday, if you like."
"It's a long journey. At least a half day if the ferries are running on time." She paused to study the binding of her journal. "I doubt we can get back at a reasonable hour. Are there hotels on Staten Island?"
Jack bit back a laugh.
"We'd shock Sister Mary Augustine right out of her shoes."
Anna's face went slack with surprise.
"What?"
She sat up straighter.
"I forgot to tell you about the letter I had from Mary Irene." She recited it to the best of her memory. "There was an odd phrase," she finished. "Something like, she was reassigned to the mother house where she can contemplate devotion to duty and detachment from self. What does it mean? Is she being punished?"
Jack said,
"I don't think they would see it that way. They are being protective."
"Ah," Anna sat back. "They are protecting her from her own curiosity and her talent. Because she is talented, Jack. She has a natural affinity for medicine."
He waited for her to come to some conclusion, and hoped she wouldn't decide to rescue Mary Augustine. He could see her doing just that, and looking to him for help.
She was saying, "I don't understand it, but I don't see what I can do either. If she wants a different life, she'll have to walk away on her own."
She glanced at him and her frown deepened.
"It's a terrible waste of a good mind."
"I agree."
"Do you really? Or are you trying to appease me?"
"Savard," Jack said, "listen to me now. I'm not the kind of man who will say anything to avoid an argument. In fact, I like arguing with you. In this case, I do agree."
"You agree that her mind is being wasted?"
Jack shifted uneasily in his seat.
"I agree that she's in a place where her gifts are not put to good use. Yes."
"Could I write to her?"
"To what end?"
She shrugged.
"I could offer her a position as a nurse. She'd have room and board and a small salary, and she could apply for medical school and a scholarship if she wants to do that. Can I write to her?"
"Believe it or not, I've never been inside a convent, and I don't have any idea what's allowed and what isn't. I wasn't raised a Catholic, you know that."
"There must be a way to get a letter to her. She's not a prisoner, is she?"
"No," Jack said, "or better said, she's not being physically restrained. But there are other ways to tie people down.
Other women liked nothing better than a compliment, but his Anna was so inordinately pleased when he offered her a way of looking at something she hadn't considered. Her smile said this was one of those moments.
"It will have to wait until after the wedding," she said. "But this weekend..."
"It will have to wait until Monday," Jack said firmly. "This weekend..." It was his turn to lift a brow.
"Staten Island."
"Have you ever been?"
"No, I've never even thought of it."
"It's a wonderful place to visit, the beaches especially. Do you have a bathing costume?" She shook her head. "We'll have to remedy that. I'd like to see your hair down with the sun shining on it." She looked away, but he went on. "You are beautiful, you know."
Anna was up in a flash, too embarrassed to sit still, unwilling to be admired.
"I'm going to keep telling you things you don't like to hear," he called after her, "until you believe them."
She threw up her hands in disgust and disappeared into the house. Anna dropped onto the sofa across from her aunt, who sat contemplating a swatch of watered silk, the tender blue-green of Sophie's eyes.
"Did the fitting go well?"
"She will be a stunning bride." Aunt Quinlan smiled at Anna, something of wistfulness in her expression. "It's a good thing you're here. I might have turned maudlin without you to distract me. Where's Jack?"
"In the garden, hatching plans. We're going to eat with his sisters this evening, to sort through some practical matters." Aunt Quinlan's eyes were damp, and she blinked hard.
"Are you all right, Auntie?"
"I was just thinking that the house will be very empty when you go away. And I'm wondering about the little girls, if you'll want to take them with you."
Anna drew in a deep breath and held it for a moment.
"I don't want to disrupt the girls now that they are settled, and I also can't imagine leaving you to handle all this on your own, especially if we manage to find the boys."
"You're so sure the younger one is on Staten Island, but why?"
"We know Father McKinaway took him from the Foundling. That's the one solid piece of information we have. So I think we need to have a plan in case we do bring him home. I know you and Mrs. Lee and Margaret like having children here, but it is too much to ask. We need to talk about hiring a nurse and a maid, too, I think."
Her aunt nodded. "You've decided to move in with the sisters, then?"
Anna bit back a laugh. "God, no. I really don't want to leave here. I can't imagine living anywhere else but here."
"Then stay," her aunt said. "Jack is welcome. You know that."
Anna wrapped her arms around herself and offered a small and regretful smile. "He's too much of a bull for this china shop, Auntie." Aunt Quinlan looked beyond Anna to the parlor door.
"Come in, Jack," she said. "We were just talking about your plans."
He sat down next to Anna, not quite touching.
"Bull in a china shop?"
A ripple of awareness ran down Anna's spine and along every nerve. She wondered if his voice would always elicit such a physical reaction from her.
"Listening at doors, mezzanotte?"
He flashed a smile at her, but spoke to Aunt Quinlan.
"I came in to see if you two would take a very short walk with me."
Aunt Quinlan reached for her cane before the words were out of Jack's mouth. Anna got up too.
"Is this what you were wanting to tell me? Where are we going?"
"Mrs. Greber's." And in response to a blank look, "Your neighbor?"
Aunt Quinlan sat down again.
"Katerina Greber."
Mrs. Greber was one of the few people Aunt Quinlan truly disliked, and her tone gave that away. Anna was glad to see that Jack had it figured out.
"I see there's some history I don't know about. You aren't the best of friends."
Anna scrambled for the shortest possible explanation.
"Aunt Quinlan believes that Mrs. Greber took..."
"Stole." that Mrs. Greber is responsible for the disappearance of one of Mr. Lee's prize roses, roots and all. There used to be a door in the wall between her garden and ours.
Anna, said Aunt Quinlan, you know she took that rose.
Jack said,
so you won't miss her, now that she's moved away.
Aunt Quinlan's expression stilled, and then she produced a huge and unapologetic smile.
Moved?
To live with a son, I think.
And the house is empty.
Jack's gaze settled on Anna.
For the moment, I was thinking we might want to buy it.
Anna, Aunt Quinlan said, if you don't kiss that man, I'll have to do it for you.
The house was far smaller than the Quinlan residence, but similar in style and solidly built, most likely by the same architect. Buff-colored limestone walls and a tile roof, the rooms not especially large, but more than sufficient. Inside, it was in desperate need of renovation and repairs, but Jack had known immediately that it would suit. The expression on Anna's face told him he was right. She went from room to room and then outside into the garden, almost as large as her aunt's, but terribly overgrown. The symmetry made it clear that this property must have once belonged to the Quinlan parcel, and according to Jack, the plat book confirmed that. Both buildings constructed in 1840 by Jonathan Quinlan, Harrison Quinlan's grandfather. In her second marriage, Lily Bonner Ballantyne had married into a family with a shipping fortune, and, more rare still, an appreciation for beauty.
Mr. Lee will need to bring this garden back to order,
Anna's aunt murmured.
There are mezzanotte cousins and nephews enough to help, Jack said to her.
But he kept his gaze on Anna.
Mr. Lee can have his pick of an army of gardeners.
Anna walked away from them into waist-high weeds, scanning the brick wall and then pointing. There's where the garden door was taken out and bricked over. Could that be restored, do you think?
It could, Jack said. I would put it at the top of the list, so you can come and go easily. It will be safer for the girls, too.
She swept around, her eyes so bright that he thought for a moment she might be on the verge of tears. How soon can it be brought into order, do you think?
I'll talk to the attorney tomorrow. We can start renovations next week, after we make plans and talk about a budget, if that's what you want to do.
She strode toward him. Of course it is, she said. It's exactly what I want. You're exactly what I want. Jack heard Aunt Quinlan moving away and the door closing behind her, just as Anna walked into his arms. She said, first on that list of things to do is to get a room together where a person can take a nap. And then she sneezed, 3 times in a row.
Good idea, Jack said, unless we want these weeds mowed down first.
She sneezed once more, a triplet of high, quick spasms that made him laugh out loud. On the way uptown later in the afternoon, Anna asked the question she could hold back no longer. How long have you had that house up your sleeve?
He shrugged. Just since yesterday. I saw a mover's wagon pulling away from the curb, and I asked some questions. This morning I talked to the attorney and made an offer. What?
Before you asked me.
It would have sold to someone else before the day ended. Did I misstep?
No, she said quite truthfully. You stepped perfectly.
And after a long moment,
this will be difficult for your sisters.
Jack touched the small of her back to steer her around a group of girls playing with a jump rope. There may be a way to lessen the sting.
She glanced up at him. You are full of surprises today. What are you thinking?
Ask for their help, Unless you want to handle the furnishing and decorating yourself, of course.
That made her laugh out loud. Do you think they're so easily distracted?
Ask them and find out. But be prepared. The first question they are going to ask you...
A date for the wedding. She sighed.
Such enthusiasm, Jack said dryly.
She pressed his arm. If the house can be ready, I would say late summer. Will that serve?
No, Jack muttered, but it will have to do.
Chapter 21. Thursday morning, Anna woke at dawn, full of energy, and left the house without eating anything at all. To step into the kitchen would mean being caught up in the frenzied preparations for the party on the East River or the wedding. All the way to the New Amsterdam, Anna kept tripping over the idea that Sophie and Cap would be getting married in just one day's time. Anna had avoided dwelling on what it would mean to be without her cousin for months or even years, but now she could think of little else. There was a lot of letter writing in her future, but she had discovered she liked writing letters to Jack, and she thought writing to Sophie and Cap might be a good thing, a way to sort through all the changes ahead. She reminded herself that she had patience to see. She tried to remember the last time she had been unhappy to have work, and could not remember a single instance. She wondered what it said about her that at almost 28 years old, she had never even imagined staying away from work. There were, in fact, more interesting and even more important things in her world. There was Cap, who would board a ship tomorrow and never come home again. Anna imagined him wrapped in blankets and looking out into a world of winter blues and whites, the cold, clear air and perfect silence of the high Alps. The urge to turn around and go spend the day with Cap and Sophie came over her and had to be dismissed. She would see her patients and then spend the afternoon and evening on the East River. The party would be a great deal of fun, everyone talking and laughing, and the noise of the celebration on the bridge would overwhelm all else. Sophie would not be there, but Jack would. At one, he would fetch her and they would go to meet the rest of the family at the ferry dock, and then she would be free for an unheard of 3.5 days, not on duty or on call until Monday. After the wedding, her time was her own, to spend dozing in the garden, or, more likely, in the new house answering questions about window hangings and linen closets, while Jack and his cousins began putting bigger things to rights, and his sisters went to work on the sewing machine they had already determined must be installed before everything else. By the time Anna reached the New Amsterdam, she had reconciled herself to the day ahead and could turn her mind to rounds with her students, to a scheduled surgery and a meeting, and to seeing 3 patients who were in decline. She left her most difficult case for the end of the workday, so that she didn't have to feel rushed. The patient was a 59-year-old woman, unmarried and without family, who would die sometime in the next day or two because she had ignored a cut on the sole of her foot too long. Anna had amputated, knowing that it was almost certainly too late, and so it had turned out to be. Rachel Branson had led a quiet, even peaceful life, but her death would be neither of those things. Anna found her patient sitting quietly, her hands folded over the newspaper in her lap while she looked out the window. Her bed was at the very end of the surgical ward, which provided her with a little more privacy and a view. Miss Branson was flushed with fever, her brow and throat damp with sweat. Pain had taken up permanent residence in her face, drawing creases down her cheeks and along her mouth. Anna reached for the chart that hung at the foot of the bed and made a note for an increase in her pain medication. She hoped that Miss Branson would slip into a coma before the pain outstripped every relief medicine had to offer. Then she sat down on the single chair, holding the chart against herself.
I've been watching the bit of the new bridge I can see.
Miss Branson told her. Such a lot of excitement, rushing back and forth. The president is there, according to the newspaper. It's a wondrous thing.
She raised her face to look at Anna.
Are you going to the celebration?
Yes, Anna said. Later this afternoon.
With friends?
Over the time she had been practicing, Anna had learned how to deflect personal questions without giving offense. But she found herself wanting to talk to Miss Branson.
With my family. It's a busy time for us. Tomorrow, my cousin is getting married, and she'll be sailing for Europe with her new husband right away.
Oh, that sounds lovely, Miss Branson said. Fireworks and a spring wedding. I wouldn't know what to do with my excitement.
It is exciting, Anna agreed.
After a long moment, Miss Branson said,
I would have liked to see the fireworks. You have a good view of the sky from this window, Anna said. You should be able to see them.
A thoughtful look passed over the older woman's face.
Maybe, she said finally.
She seemed to rouse herself purposefully.
I have a little savings, she said. I've written out instructions for the bank to release those funds to the hospital to pay for my care, and afterward.
Some people needed to talk about practical matters, unwilling or unable to let go of details. Miss Branson outlined her arrangements for her small apartment and what would become of her things, and Anna listened without interrupting her.
But really what I wanted to tell you is that I have some lovely hats, she was saying. Do you think you might like to have them?
Startled, Anna marshaled her thoughts, but Miss Branson held up a hand to forestall Anna's answer.
They are my own work, the best of my work. I started in a milliner's shop when I was just 8 years old, 6 days a week, from 7 in the morning to 7 in the evening. At first I swept floors, and at 30 I was the designer. I trained under old Mr. Malcolm, and then I worked for his son, and finally his grandson. My whole life in that one place. 50 years in the same shop on the same street.
That is a very long time.
He's still alive, Miss Branson said. Her gaze was far away, but her tone was matter of fact. The first Mr. Malcolm. 94 years old, but still spry. The kind of elderly gentleman who seems just as dry and tough as gristle.
She glanced at Anna, who nodded that she understood.
But terribly absent-minded about everything outside his business. Even when I first knew him, Mr. Malcolm could never remember birthdays, not even his own, or anniversaries or invitations. And he mixed up his children, running through all the names until he hit the right one, Jacob Hans Jeb or Emity Ruth Josie, just like that. They laughed it off, though I think when the children were little, there were some hurt feelings now and then. I didn't see it at first, but as I got older, I realized that it wasn't really comical. How much passed him by? How many small good things in his life went unnoticed?
She turned her head to watch the activity on the bridge for a moment, and then she picked up her story again.
He was a strict taskmaster, but not mean, never mean. Gruff but good-hearted is how I think of him. My own father died young, and I felt the lack, so I sometimes pretended that Mr. Malcolm was my father. I think the idea came to me because he always remembered my name, you see. His daughters he couldn't keep straight, but he knew my name. And that made me think I was a little special.
Anna was fairly sure that Miss Branson had had no visitors, though she had been admitted to the hospital the previous Saturday.
I sent word Monday morning. Paid a messenger to take a note to say I was here and couldn't come in. Didn't hear back, but after you told me my situation, I thought I should write again. But maybe not. They might be closed up for the celebration. They might.
Anna drew in a deep breath and held it. The simplest of stories,
and her heart was beating so fiercely she could feel the